Good morning. It's very good to be with you guys this morning, and I would like to thank the elders for this opportunity to speak to you this morning. Also, I'd like to say thank you to Micah for reading that scripture reading for me. I will say this, and it's not just because he's my nephew. This goes to all the young men. It is very encouraging to see you guys get up here, read scripture, lead prayers. And before I start, I'll tell a quick story on myself. The first time I had to give a scripture reading to Town Church of Christ, I was probably about 12 years old, scared out of my mind, cried like a baby before services, so bad, in fact, that my dad said, you know what, you're not ready for this, I'll do it for you. It was about another year before I did it on a Sunday morning where we had no power in the building and there was like five of us there and I was still scared to death. But hey, you guys, you're doing great. You're younger than I was, and if I'm any indication, you'll be up here giving a sermon in 10 years and your knees will be shaking as well. For today's sermon, I've chosen to talk about the Ark of the Covenant, and I've titled this Following the Ark. So as I introduce this, I'll give the backstory why I would choose such a kind of peculiar topic. And this goes back to early 21, probably about March. I was teaching a young adults class there where we attended, and studies that we did was on David. And, you know, David to me is one of my favorite character studies in the Bible. I always get a lot when I study out a study about David. And one of the lessons in particular was about David and his bringing the ark back to Jerusalem. And I posed this question to the class, and I'll pose it here. When you think of the Ark of the Covenant, what's the first thing that you think of? I'll let you think about that for a second. And then I'll show you what my answer is. My answer is Indiana Jones, because as in modern-day America, that's the only thing I think of when I think of the Ark of the Covenant. And so I was not alone in thinking that, by the way, in that class, and I doubt I was alone in this auditorium either, because it's a very popular movie, and you're old enough to see it, you probably thought of the Ark of the Covenant. So that posed another question to my mind. Why is it that Indiana Jones is the first thing I think about when I think of the Ark of the Covenant? So in order to find my answer, I decided to basically follow the Ark through the Old Testament, from its creation to its disappearance. And that's what I'd like to share with you guys this morning. I'd like to take you on that journey from its creation to its disappearance to see if we can't come to the answer ourselves as to why the Ark of the Covenant just really isn't prevalent to us in modern-day America. I'd ask you to turn to Exodus chapter 25, and we're going to start reading in verse 10. Exodus 25, starting in verse 10. We're going to read about the commandment to create the ark. They shall make an ark of acacia wood. 2 cubits and a half shall be its length, 1.5 cubits its breadth, and 1.5 cubits its height. You shall overlay it with pure gold. Inside and outside you shall overlay it. And you shall make on it a molding of gold around it. You shall cast 4 rings of gold for it, and put them on its 4 feet, 2 rings on the one side of it, and 2 rings on the other side of it. You shall make poles of acacia wood, and overlay them with gold. And you shall put the poles into the rings on the sides of the ark to carry the ark by them. The poles shall remain in the rings of the ark, they shall not be taken from it. And you shall put into the ark the testimony that I shall give you. You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold, 2.5 cubits shall be its length, and 1.5 cubits its breadth. And you shall make 2 cherubim of gold, of hammered work shall you make them, on the 2 ends of the mercy seat. Make 1 cherub on the one end and the other, and 1 cherub on the other end. Of 1 piece with the mercy seat shall you make the cherubim on its 2 ends. The cherubim shall spread out their wings above, overshadowing the mercy seat with their wings. Their faces one to another, toward the mercy seat shall the faces of the cherubim be. And you shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony that I shall give you. There I will meet you, and from above the mercy seat, from between the 2 cherubim that are the ark of the testimony, I will speak with you about all that I will give you in the commandment for the people of Israel. So in Exodus chapter 25, God gives a command to create the ark. He is very specific on the dimensions, what materials to use. Just in researching the materials, acacia wood, just fun fact, very common wood for cutting boards. It's a very porous wood that absorbs water very well, so you don't really need to know that, but it's a fun fact for the day. And then it was to be overlaid with gold. And then the mercy seat was to be on top, and that was to be completely overlaid with gold as well. And it had the two cherubim, which my understanding looked like kind of more like angels with the wings spread out facing each other. And this would be where God would minister to the people. And this is a very not-to-scale box, but just to show you that in our modern terminology, it was about 27 inches wide by 45 inches long and 27 inches tall. So, you know, I always thought this was a great, massive box, right? It's not really all that big, but it still was pretty good size, and that would have been a lot of gold. So the next place we're going to turn to be Numbers chapter 4, read verse 15. Numbers 4 and verse 15. And you'll notice today, as I said, we're taking a journey. You're not going to be turning left a lot in your Bibles. You're actually only going to turn left once, and that's just because I chose a passage in Chronicles and not Samuel. So turning right in your Bibles, we're going to go to Numbers chapter 4, verse 15. And that reads, "And when Aaron and his sons have finished covering the sanctuary and all the furnishings of the sanctuary, as the camp sits out, after that the sons of Kohath shall come to carry these. But they must not touch the holy things, lest they die. These are the things of the tent of meeting that the sons of Kohath are to carry." So God is, again, he's very specific in all that he said. He's very specific who was going to carry the ark, and not only the ark, but all the items inside of the tabernacle or the Holy of Holies as well. The ark was one of these. So again, we're very specific on the command. The sons of Kohath are to carry these. And also, which we will get to later, very specific command not to touch the ark or any of the holy items. So in this lesson, I have really 4 points that I'd like to draw on through my study that I found very relevant, and I figured I would share with you. So the first one is God used the ark to lead his people to the promised land. So the next passage we'll turn to would be Numbers chapter 10, starting in verse 33. Numbers chapter 10, starting verse 33, we're going to read about the ark's first journey when they have left the mountain. Starting verse 33, it reads, "So they set out from the mountain of the Lord 3 days' journey, and the ark of the covenant of the Lord went before them 3 days' journey to seek out a resting place for them. And the cloud of the Lord was over them by day whenever they set out from the camp. And whenever the ark set out, Moses said, 'Arise, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you.' And when it rested, he said, 'Return, O Lord, to the 10,000s of Israel.'" So we see here that as they're wandering through the wilderness, they're making their way towards Canaan, that the ark would go before them, and they would follow. And so this was God leading his people through the wandering in the wilderness to the promised land. And the next place we're going to turn, which Micah read some of it for me, would be in Joshua chapter 3, starting in verse 2. We're going to read about the crossing of the Jordan. And one thing I would like to just point out, and it says this in the Bible, but I'm not going to take the time to read everything this morning, because if I read everything, I'll be up here for an hour. But as it mentions, when it comes to the crossing of the Jordan, this was at the time of harvest, and this was a time when the Jordan River was overflowing its banks. So imagine not a calm, peaceful, steady flowing river. This is a pretty raging river right now. Okay, this water is flowing, and it's flowing good. And so in Joshua chapter 3, starting verse 2, it reads, "And at the end of 3 days, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people, 'As soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priests, then you shall set out from the place and follow it. Yet there shall be a distance between you and it, about 2,000 cubits in length. Do not come near it, in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before.' Then Joshua said to the people, 'Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you.' And Joshua said to the priests, 'Take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass on before the people.' So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people." Pause real quick to talk about verse 5. I absolutely love that saying, "Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you." That's why I have it highlighted there. I'm a visual guy. I like to put myself in the situation. And I always imagine myself hearing that, just how excited I would have been to wake up tomorrow to see what was going to happen. And to be able to read the account of what does happen, that's truly amazing. So, like I said, for the sake of time, we're just going to talk about what actually does happen when they get to the water. So the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant, they go in first, and as soon as their sandals touch the water stops coming down and it stops flowing. And so you have this great span of dry land now that is formed where the Israelites cross the Jordan River. And the priests stay in the middle of the river until everybody has crossed, and then they themselves walk out. And once their sandals have left, the water instantly comes raging back. And so God used the ark here. Basically, God sat in the middle of the river. It's kind of how it comes down until all his people were across, and then he let the water come back. The next place we're going to go is Jericho, just over the river. In Joshua chapter 6, starting in verse 6, it reads, "So Joshua the son of Nun called the priests and said to them, 'Take up the ark of the covenant, and let seven priests bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of the Lord.' And he said to the people, 'Go forward, march around the city, and let the armed men pass on before the ark of the Lord.'" So we're all familiar with the story of Jericho. You know, this great fortified city that could not be defeated. And Israel comes, and God tells them not to attack it, not to do anything you'd normally do in war, but to just walk around it. And for 6 days, they took one lap around. And then on the final day, they walked seven times around, shouting, blowing trumpets, and then the walls came tumbling down. And the ark was there being carried around, and God brought the walls down. So, some other movements of the ark. We have in Joshua chapter 18 and verse 1, the tabernacle, or tent of meeting, was set up at Shiloh, and this would be where the ark would spend a lot of its time, because this is where it should have been. And then Judges chapter 20, verses 26 through 27, the ark was in Bethel at the time of Israel's war against Gibeah, aka the Sodom and Gomorrah of Israel. It's a very good study. Brother Heath had talked about when we did our Judges study, and I thoroughly enjoyed that. And then 1 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 3, Hannah's husband goes to Shiloh to worship and sacrifice. And chapter 3, verse 3, Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord where the ark was. So at this point, it was back in Shiloh. So the second point I would like to make this morning, and I'd ask you to go ahead and turn to the book of 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel chapter 4 is where we'll start. We're going to spend a lot of time in 1 Samuel. We're going to start in chapter 4, and we're going to work our way through a couple of these chapters as we see the ark's travelings when it has been captured. So to set the scene here, Israel is at war against the Philistines. And on, let's just call it day one of this battle, they go out, and I believe it's 3,000 or 4,000 men of Israel fall in battle. And they say, "Why is God not with us?" Well, I know why God's not with us. Because he's not here. Right? That's what they thought. So they call out to Hophni and Phinehas, the sons of Eli, and they have them bring the Ark of the Covenant down to the battlefield. And just real quick, it's hard to think of Phinehas and not think of Ferb, but he has nothing to do with this story. The kids get that reference. So the Ark of the Covenant comes down, and when the Ark arrives at the camp, the children of Israel, they let out this great roar, this great commotions in the camp, because they're excited, because, oh, we're going to win now, our God is here, because they thought that's how it worked. Well, we're going to find out it's not. And when the Philistines heard this great roar, 1 Samuel chapter 4, starting in verse 7, it says, "The Philistines were afraid, for they said, 'A God has come into the camp.' And they said, 'Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us. Who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness.'" So, as we know, our God has a reputation, right? And it was known even back then. He was known for how he humbled all the little g gods in Egypt, and how he was with the Israelites throughout their wandering in the wilderness when they were obeying him. And so when the ark comes into the camp, the Philistines are now scared to death. But that fear lasted for about a minute, And then in verse 9 it reads, "Take courage and be men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews, as they have been to you. Be men and fight." And then in verses 10 and 11, we read about the battle, and we find out that 30,000 men of Israel died that day. So while they thought bringing the Ark of the Covenant meant God was with them, he was not with them. And he made that very evident. And in fact, the Ark of the Covenant was actually captured at this point and taken into the Philistine land. And when the news of this comes back, Hophni and Phinehas that we talked about earlier, they also die. When the news of this comes back to Eli, he was about 98 years old at the time, and as the Bible tells us, he was very old and very heavy, is how it puts it in my Bible. He hears the news that his sons have died, and then he hears the news that the ark has been captured, and he falls back, and he breaks his neck, and he dies. And that is the last we read of Eli, and then Samuel will actually be the judge over Israel going forward at this point. So next, I'd like to move on to the travelings throughout Philistine, and that starts in chapter 5. So if you would, we're going to start reading 1 Samuel chapter 5. When the Philistines captured the Ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon and set it up beside Dagon. And when the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and put him back in his place. But when they rose early on the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. This is why the priests of Dagon and all who entered the house of Dagon do not tread on the threshold of Dagon and Ashdod to this day. We're going to pause right there and talk about this. So the Philistines, they took it to Ashdod here, and they put it in the house of Dagon. Dagon was one of the Philistine gods, and they put it in his house. And the next morning when they wake up, imagine, if you will, this great statue, right, that has now fallen over face down, basically bowing to the Ark of the Covenant. And they don't really think too much of it. Yeah, that's kind of weird. Must have been a stiff breeze last night, right? They prop him back up. Well, God removes all doubt the next day, because now its head and its hands have been removed. They have been cut off, and they have been severed. And I love how it puts it in verse 5. It says, this is why nobody goes there anymore, okay? This little g god has been totally disproven by our God. And I love how it says nobody goes there to this day. And then, so we're going to pick back up reading verse 6. The hand of the Lord was heavy against the people of Ashdod, and he terrified and afflicted them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. And when the men of Ashdod saw how things were, they said, the ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is hard against us and against Dagon, our God. And we're going to pause there again, because I cannot leave that without, you know, saying something about it. Let me suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, if you have to protect your God, you're serving the wrong God, okay? And the Philistines figure that out. And I'm going to tell you right now, our God needs no protection. We serve the one true living God who is the creator of all the earth, and he does not need our protection. So we are not going to find ourselves in the situation the Philistines found themselves right here, where they're saying, get this thing out of here. It is oppressing our God. And it was oppressing them, too. Like, they were suffering as well. So, picking up in verse 8, so they sent and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, what shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel? They answered, let the ark of the God of Israel be brought around to Gath. So they brought the ark of God of Israel there. But after they had brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against the city, causing a very great panic. And he afflicted the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. So they sent the ark of God to Ekron. But as soon as the ark of God came to Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out, they have brought around to us the ark of God of Israel to kill us and our people. We'll pause right there. So it has not made it to now its third city. It's made it to its third city. And the first thing the people say is, why have you brought this here? It's here to kill us. Okay? Because everywhere this ark is gone in the land of the Philistines, it has brought nothing but pain and suffering. And so picking back up there in verse 11, they sent therefore and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, send away the ark of the God of Israel, and let it return to its own place, that it may not kill us and our people. for there was a deathly panic throughout the whole city. The hand of God was very heavy there. The men who did not die were struck with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. So, as I mentioned, the ark, everywhere it went, it brought tumors, it brought pain, suffering. It was not a fun time to be a Philistine. And it was definitely not a time you wanted to look out your window and see the Ark of the Covenant coming down the road towards your city. And so at this point, in chapter 6, which I'll kind of paraphrase a lot of this for us this morning, they get together, they call together their all the leaders, and they call together a priest, and they say, what do we do with this thing? What should we do? And he tells them what you should do. And he says, take it, put it on a cart, and put two milking cows that have never had a yoke on them, lock up their calves at home, and just let it go. See what happens. If the hand of God has been against you, they will go straight to Israel, or straight to, I believe it's Kiriath-Jearim. And then you will know that the Lord has been afflicting you, because it will go back. Because that's not natural, okay? You don't put two milking cows on a yoke that have never pulled anything in their lives, not to mention you put their little calves locked up at home. It's not a mother's instinct to just leave their babies. And so as we'll read, and that is in verse 10 of chapter 6. But before I read that real quick, I would just like to read verse 6, which says, why should you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? After he dealt severely with them, did they not send the people away? And they departed. And I just love how even though history wasn't fully recorded, that even the Philistines heard about the great works that our Lord had done in Egypt, and that resonated with them. They were like, oh yeah, we don't want to be like them. We don't want to harden our hearts. We want to let this thing go so the oppression will stop. So then moving on down to verse 10, the men did so and took two milk cows and yoked them to the cart and shut up their calves at home. And they put the ark of the Lord on the cart and the box with the golden mice and the images of their tumors. And the cows went straight in the direction of Beth Shemesh along one highway, lowing as they went. They turned neither to the right nor to the left, and the lords of the Philistines went after them as far as the border of Beth Shemesh. Now the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their harvest in the valley, and when they lifted up their eyes and saw the ark, they rejoiced to see it. So, as I mentioned, they followed what the priest had told them to do down to the letter, and again, it's not natural for two cows to not even wander. Nobody had to be on this cart to tell them where to go. They went straight, made a straight beeline for Beth Shemesh. And when it got to Beth Shemesh, the people got a little bit carried away as they were celebrating that it was back. Verse 19 reads, and he struck some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked upon the ark of the Lord. He struck 70 men of them, and the people mourned because the Lord had struck the people with a great blow. Then the men of Beth Shemesh said, who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God? And to whom shall he go up away from us? So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kiriath-Jearim, saying, the Philistines have returned the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up to you. And the men of Kiriath-Jearim came and took up the ark of the Lord and brought it to the house of Abinadab on the hill. And they consecrated his son Eleazar to have charge of the ark of the Lord. From the day that the ark was lodged at Kiriath-Jearim, a long time passed, some 20 years, and all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. So where it's at right now in the house of Abinadab is actually where it would remain until King David will come onto the scene to bring it back to Jerusalem. So it's going to spend all of King Saul's time in this house, and then however long into David's reign until he went and got it. So my third point I'd like to make this morning, this is where we're going to spend some time talking about David, is when commands were kept, great blessings followed the ark. But when they weren't followed, that's when the blessings weren't there. And for this, I actually would like to turn to 1 Chronicles. I like this account of it a little bit more. 1 Chronicles chapter 13 is where this is found. 1 Chronicles chapter 13. David consulted with the commanders of thousands and of hundreds, with every leader. And David said to all the assembly of Israel, if it seems good to you from the Lord our God, let us send abroad to our brothers who remain in all the lands of Israel. as well as the priests and the Levites and the cities that have pasture lands, that they may be gathered to us. Then let us bring again the ark of our God to us, for we did not seek it in the days of Saul. All of the assembly agreed to do so, for the thing was right in the eyes of all the people. We'll pause right there. And, you know, this shows, honestly, I like this version better for this one reason. It shows David's initial intentions, right? His heart was in the right place. His execution on how he got there is where he went wrong. But it shows his heart was in the right place, where it says, then let us bring the ark of our God to us, for we did not seek it, or another version says, seek him in the days of Saul. So Israel, as we know, had left God during the reign of Saul, because Saul was their leader, and everybody's going to follow their leader, right? And then David, he made it his personal mission to kind of restore the soul of the nation, right? And I know that's a popular phrase nowadays for different reasons, but David actually did it. And David, you know, said, one of the things we need to do is get the Ark of the Covenant back to where it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be in Jerusalem. Let's get it back. So picking back up in verse 5, so David assembled all Israel from the Nile of Egypt to Lebo Hamath to bring the Ark of God from Kirith-Jearim. And David and all Israel went up to Bala, that is to Kirith-Jearim, that belongs to Judah, to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord who sits enthroned above the cherubim. And they carried the Ark of God on a new cart from the house of Abinadab, and Uzzah and Ahio were driving the cart. And David and all Israel were celebrating before God with all their might, with songs and lyres and harps and tambourines and cymbals and trumpets. And if the story stopped right there, it would be a good story, correct? But unfortunately, the story does not. Picking back up in verse 9, and when they came to the threshing floor of Chidon, Uzzah put out his hand to take hold of the ark, for the oxen stumbled. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and he struck him down because he put out his hand to the ark, and he died there before God. And David was angry because the Lord had broken out against Uzzah. And that place is called Para Uzzah to this day. My Bible has a footnote that reads, Para Uzzah means breaking out against Uzzah, or the lashing out against Uzzah. And David was afraid of God that day, and he said, how can I bring the ark of God home to me? So David did not take the ark home into the city of David, but took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. And the ark of God remained with the household of Obed-Edom in his house 3 months, and the Lord blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that he had. So David failed to follow what I like to call the rings and the poles of the law, and it cost Uzzah his life. What do I mean by the rings of the poles? Exodus chapter 25 and verse 14 tells us, and you shall put the poles into the rings on the sides of the ark to carry the ark by them. Numbers 4:15, the sons of Kohath shall come to carry these, but they must not touch the holy things, lest they die. In verse 19 of Numbers 4, it says, but deal thus with them, that they may live and not die when they come near to the most holy things. So we have those three verses right there to tell us what to do. But what do those three verses not tell us? They don't tell us, thou shalt not carry the ark on a cart pulled by oxen. And that is what David interpreted that he was allowed to do, because it did not say to not to. And that is what got him in trouble. And this is just going to be a quick little side route we're going to take. But I think there's some modern day rings and poles that can get us into trouble as well. First and foremost, this is probably the most obvious one I can point out, would be instrumental music. We're commanded to sing and make melody in our hearts. Well, it doesn't say don't strum the guitar. And I like the way that sounds. That's not what God asked for. And that's where we need to be very careful about leaving things up to our own interpretation. Another one would be skipping services for worldly pleasures. Brother Hobart read the passage that I always forget, which is in Hebrews 10. Thank you for reading that. To not forsake the assembly. And I'll be the first to tell you right now, I fully understand that some jobs have exceptions or create opportunities where you might not be here every Wednesday night. I work one of those. I did not sign up for one of those jobs, but that's what I have. But there's a difference between missing services for work, or you're sick, or you're taking care of a loved one, and going to Kings Island, or going to a baseball game, or going to a football game. I'll share a story, and something that rings home to me with this point is growing up, I had a teacher there at the Fair Town Church of Christ who would always pound this into our heads that If you have the opportunity to be here at services, you need to be here. And I grew up hearing that and hearing that and hearing that. And I'm ashamed to say that that same deacon in the church that taught us that, just out of the blue, one Sunday, there's a picture on Facebook. He went to a race, and he didn't go to church. And it got farther and farther, and to where he is no longer a faithful member of the Church of Christ. And that really hits home with me. It's like, if you start doing that, be careful, okay? Because that can lead one thing to another. The next point I have would be the use of foul language. The Bible tells us to avoid idle words, but it doesn't tell us what four-letter words or three-letter words not to say. And that's where, you know, we have to interpret for ourselves what words we're not to use. I'm a firm believer, having worked with auto mechanics and factory workers my whole life, that if you want to stick out, don't talk like them. It's a pretty easy way to stick out. And you'll get asked about that. And I honestly believe that's the easiest conversation starter for Jesus and for our faith. Because, like I said, if you want to stand out, the quickest way to do it is to not sound like everybody else. And then the last one I have would be social drinking. And again, I've only known one person that ever made this argument. I'm not saying anybody here has, but again, I would appeal to the image of doing such things. If you want to set yourself aside from the world, you probably shouldn't act like the world, and this is a very common thing that the world does. So after that, we're going to move back to our talk about the ark. And in 1 Chronicles chapter 15, David is going to bring the ark back. And if you do notice, just jump back real quick there to chapter 13. At the end, David puts it in the house of Obed-Edom, and he leaves it there for 3 months. And I don't want to call it a temper tantrum or a fit, but it kind of was, because he said, you know, I wanted to bring this to Jerusalem, and now you've lashed out against us. I'm just going to leave this here because I don't know how to get it back. And as we see here, it took David 3 months to figure it out. And this is not actually the first time that it's taken David some time to get his life straightened back out. Actually, with the case of Bathsheba, it's at least 9 months before he's ready to repent. It's very easy in the Bible sometimes to think that stuff is the next day just because it's two verses later. But very important there in the case of Bathsheba, you read at the end of one chapter that the baby's born, and then the start of the very next chapter, then Nathan the prophet is coming to David. So there's at least 9 months there where David had to think about that and get his heart ready to repent. All right, so moving on to chapter 15, starting in verse 1. David built houses for himself in the city of David, and he prepared a place for the ark of God and pitched a tent for it. Then David said to them, "No one but the Levites may carry the ark of God, for the Lord had chosen them to carry the ark of the Lord and to minister to him forever." And David assembled all of Israel at Jerusalem to bring up the ark of the Lord to its place, which he had prepared for it, and jumped down to verse 12, so I don't have to read all these names. And David said to them, "You are the heads of the father's house of the Levites. Consecrate yourselves, you and your brothers, so that you may bring up the ark of the Lord, the God of Israel, to the place that I have prepared for it. Because you did not carry it the first time, the Lord our God broke out against us, because we did not seek him according to the rule." So we see here, I don't know what David did, but he did some homework. If he did nothing else, he did some homework. And he figured out how he is supposed to carry the ark. And so you see him being very specific. We are going to do this by the letter of the law this time, and we are going to bring this ark to Jerusalem. So at this point, the ark is moved to Jerusalem, and it would remain in the tent that David had built for it until his son came around and was ready to build the temple. So that's Solomon, and that's found in 1 Kings chapter 8, starting in verse 1. 1 Kings chapter 8, starting in verse 1. Then Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the leaders of the father's houses of the people of Israel before King Solomon in Jerusalem to bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord out of the city of David, which is Zion. And all the men of Israel assembled to King Solomon at the feast in the month Ethanim, which is the seventh month. And all the elders of Israel came, and the priests took up the ark. And they brought the ark up, and they brought up the ark of the Lord, the tent of meeting, and all the holy vessels that were in the tent. The priests and the Levites brought them up. And King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who had assembled before him were with him before the ark, sacrificing so many sheep and oxen that they could not be counted or numbered. Then the priests brought the ark of the covenant to the Lord, of the Lord, to its place in the inner sanctuary of the house, in the most holy place underneath the wings of the cherubim. For the cherubim spread out their wings over the place of the ark, so that the cherubim overshadowed the ark and its poles. And the poles were so long that the ends of the poles were seen from the holy place before the inner sanctuary, but they could not be seen from outside. And they are there to this day. There was nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone that Moses put there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the people of Israel. When they came out of the land of Egypt, and when the priests came out of the holy place, a cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of God filled the house of the Lord. So we read here, the ark is moved into the temple. As we also read, there's a great cloud that fills the house of the Lord, and everybody that's in it has to get out, because I don't know if they couldn't breathe or couldn't see or what, but they said, we have to get out of here. So the glory of God was in the temple that day. And then we're going to move on to 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verse 17 and 19. And I'll have you notice right off the bat, you're not going to actually read about the Ark of the Covenant in this verse. But if the Ark of the Covenant was here at this time, this is definitely the last time we're ever going to read about it. This is when King Nebuchadnezzar is going to invade. The temple is going to be destroyed, and all of its all the precious items and vessels are going to be destroyed. So like I said, this is the last time, if the Ark of the Covenant was here, that we're going to read about it. The reason I say I don't know for a fact that it's here is actually just a few chapters before this, when King Josiah had the scrolls of the law read, they said, oh, hey, let's go get the ark. I don't know where the ark was, but they went and got the ark and brought it back. So again, like I said earlier, just a couple chapters can mean a whole lot of time in the Bible. So I have no concrete fact proof that this is where the ark was at this time, but if it was, this is definitely the last time we're going to read about it. 2 Chronicles 36, starting verse 17, reads, therefore he brought up against them the king of the Chaldeans, who killed their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion on young man or virgin, old man or aged. He gave them all into his hand, and all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of all the kings of his princes, all these he brought to Babylon. And they burned the house of God and broke down the wall of Jerusalem and burned all its palaces with fire and destroyed all its precious vessels. So I tell you all that to get to Jeremiah chapter 3, starting verse 16, where we're going to answer my question. Jeremiah 3:16 answers my question, why do I think of Indiana Jones? And it reads, When you have multiplied and been fruitful in the land in those days, declares the Lord, they shall say no more, the ark of the covenant of the Lord. It shall not come to mind or be remembered or missed. It shall not be made again. At that time, Jerusalem shall be called the throne of the Lord, and all nations shall gather to it, to the presence of the Lord in Jerusalem, and they shall no more stubbornly follow their own evil. So right there, that tells me why I do not think of it. It tells me right in the verse, you're not going to miss it. And that's because Jesus is going to come down, Jesus is going to die, and Jesus is going to lay down the new law, the New Testament, for how we are to live our lives. And this is why the Ark of the Covenant and all the things of the old law don't come to my mind every single day. So this can go into a whirlwind of hypotheticals, which we are not going to get into. Why has the ark never been found? I'll tell you straight up, first thing I'm going to say is this is 100% my theory, but my theory is God doesn't want it found, or it's been destroyed. And I say that because, you know, the Ark of the Covenant in the Old Testament, very physical. It was a physical law, right? And I believe if, and today, the age of the spiritual, if we had part of the physical, it would present a stumbling block. That's how I view it. Because this is a physical part, this served as the seed of God. Well, hold on a minute, we still have this thing, and we still know what the old law says. Should we be following it? And that's why I think it's not still here. If you have your own theories, I'd love to hear them afterwards. My last and final theory is it has been found, but they touched it. I don't know. I know one thing for sure. If it ever is found and it's come to a museum near me, I am not going to touch it. Not going to test that one. So my final point I'd like to make, which I kind of hinted to there in Jeremiah, is Christ is our ark. So you notice here the points that I made with the Ark of the Covenant. God used the ark to lead his people. Well, Jesus guides our path in our lives. He laid out the whole New Testament as a better way of living, a better way for us to live our lives in order to be with him one day in heaven. God used the ark to show his power. Well, Jesus did that as well. Jesus showed us his power and his love. We could have sermon after sermon after sermon about the miracles of Jesus, and time would fail us. And as we're told, there's not enough books on earth to contain all the works of Jesus. And then finally, when commands were kept, great blessings followed the ark. And when we can receive the greatest blessing of all by following Jesus. To kind of close this lesson out, I would like to turn to Hebrews chapter 9 and read this chapter for us. I believe this chapter does a very good job of comparing the Old Testament to how it is today under Christ. I know this is not the shortest to read, but I think it will help bring this lesson all together. So starting in verse 1. Now even the first covenant had regulations for worship in an earthly place of holiness. For a tent was prepared, the first section, in which were the lampstand and the table of the bread of the presence. It is called the holy place. Behind the second curtain was a second section called the most holy place, having the golden altar of incense and the ark of the covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden urn holding the manna and Aaron's staff that budded in the tablets of the covenant. Above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. Of these things, we cannot speak in detail. I'll just pause right there and say, even at the time of Hebrews, they really had no memory of these things. This is probably, I'm going to give a rough estimate, at least 600 years post-Ark of the Covenant ever being found in Israel. So even in the time of Hebrews, they can't speak of these things in detail because they themselves never saw them. Picking back up in verse 6, these preparations having thus been made, the priests go regularly into the first section, performing their ritual duties. But into the second, only the high priest goes, and he but once a year, and not without taking blood, which he offers for himself and for the unintentional sins of the people. By this, the Holy Spirit indicates that the way into the holy places is not yet opened as long as the first section is still standing, which is symbolic for the present age. According to this arrangement, gifts and sacrifices are offered that cannot perfect the conscience of the worshiper, but deal only with food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body imposed until the time of Reformation. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, he entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of blood of the blood of goats and calves, but by means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. For if the blood of goats and bulls and the sprinkling of defiled persons with the ashes of a heifer sanctify for the purification of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God? Therefore, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance, since a death has occurred that redeems them from the transgressions committed under the first covenant. For where a will is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established, for a will takes effect only at death, since it is not in force as long as the one who made it is alive. Therefore, not even the first covenant was inaugurated without blood. For then every commandment of the law had been declared by Moses to all the people. He took the blood of calves and goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant that God commanded for you." And in the same way, he sprinkled with the blood both the tent and all the vessels used in worship. Indeed, under the law, almost everything is purified with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. Thus, it was necessary for the copies of the heavenly things to be purified with these rites, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ has entered not into holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true things, but into heaven itself, not to appear in the presence of God on our behalf, nor was it to offer himself repeatedly as a high priest enters the holy place every year with blood not his own. For then he would have had to suffer repeatedly since the foundation of the world. But as it is, he has appeared once for all at the end of ages to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And just as it is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes the judgment, so Christ, having been offered to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sins, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. So, by way of invitation this morning, I would just like to share something that I've read before and I find very encouraging. And that's the idea that no matter how far away you have departed from God, it only takes one step to start your journey back to him. And I would encourage anyone here this morning, whether you have never been baptized or whether you have been and you have fallen away, just remember, it only takes one step to start your journey back to God. And I encourage you to take that step as we stand and sing.